Now we're pursuing the idea of David. As I told you, there are over 50 references to David in the New Testament. And that's pretty significant, because this thing keeps coming up all the time, this thing of David, which indicates that the Spirit must have something for us in that area. One of the very comforting things about David is that he was regarded as a man after God's heart. In fact, one of the references in the New Testament, Acts 13, indicates that David was a man after God's own heart. And that was in spite of the very unsteady life that he had. That is, the struggles that he had with his life. And he got into some mischief. And he got into some things that were serious. He paid a price for that in the flesh. But that didn't rule him out of God's favor, God's kingdom. I think that's so important for us today, to be able to identify with Christ on a basis of peace and not happiness at all. I don't really press the idea of happiness, because it's too uncertain. In fact, even the definition of happiness is uncertain. You don't know what it is. If you ask people what they want out of life, they might say, well, I want to be happy, but they wouldn't know what happiness is. So we never really go for happiness, but contentment, yes. That being a Christian, being a child of God, should bring a measure of at least being at ease or at peace in one's life. Now, this is a thing that we find with David, that being a child of God, as he was able, even in the midst of his continual struggles, to express contentment and peace. One of the tragedies in the church today is the constant tendency to hammer away on the sheep. I've never yet met a pastor that was really happy with his people. There's always something. That was satisfied with them. It's always something. They weren't giving enough, or praying enough, or going out enough, or whatever. But they just keep stirring up the sheep, stirring them up and stirring them up. It's not without significance that the Christians are called sheep, and not without significance that David was a shepherd, and that Jesus' first announcement, or the first announcement of Jesus' birth, was to shepherds. It meant something. It was a key to something. Now, I've often said that too many pastors are cowboys. You know, they're trying to drive the cattle, and instead of just shepherding the sheep, they're driving the cattle. And sheep are not made to be driven. But you go by a pasture somewhere where the sheep are feeding or grazing, and you see the very epitome of peace, tranquility. It's one of the most tranquil scenes you'll ever lay your eyes on, is a sheep grazing in the pasture, in the fields. We have quite a few that come up for that Sunday meeting. We have a meeting up there at 10 o'clock Sunday morning, or 10:15. And lots of young couples there, and a lot of babies, children. I've tried to give the feeling there that we're not really properly, as believers, we should not be really coming to some formal lecture series or seminar, because I have to use the word seminar to get the business situation, tax situation right. But so I've called those meetings seminars. But people come, and I say it's just like a big family. It's like you come to somebody's house for Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving dinner, and the kids are there, and everybody's milling around and so forth. And we don't bother to separate all the children into a special room with an attendant when we come to Christmas dinner. And it's informal, and we share and talk together. And I like that feeling there in the group, that people wouldn't be afraid to bring their families, bring their babies. And they're not. They come, you know. And it doesn't matter to me, but you know, as I have said to them, when you pass sheep out there, some are sleeping, some are grazing, the little lambs are gambling about, and so forth. And it's a picture of just free easy contentment. And that's what we ought to have. No, we've made out of Christianity such a science, such a specialized thing, that instead of being part of a family, people feel more like part of an organization or an institution. And we call a church an institution, and we shouldn't. Because that's not what it is. It's a body of believers that come and share their life together, and fellowship, and study the Word together, enjoy one another. That's what it should be. I am totally opposed to all of this anxiety-producing... I was going to say dribble, and I think I won't say it, but you know what I feel. For the sake of the tape, I won't say dribble. But it's totally out of place, totally off base, has nothing to do with the truth of the Scripture. Built upon ignorance, built upon superficial analogies and so forth, and it leaves the sheep in anxiety instead of just being able to enjoy life with Christ, which we should be able to do. Everybody's worried about what's going to happen next, and the place is going to be blown up or something. But people are anxious. They shouldn't be. I have a deep concern. I've been concerned enough to give a very, very concentrated amount of attention to this thing with the anxiety-prone presentations of Christendom today, of the church. Of the ministry, keeping the Christians always stirred up because the reason they do it is leverage. Very clear to me that that's what they want. If they can get people stirred up, frightened enough, or anxious enough, they'll get them to give more or go to work more, and they think they need that leverage. So they kind of push people into the thought that the United States is about to collapse and that all these great terrors of revelation are going to be coming down upon our heads without understanding anything at all about the real heart of what God is saying in the prophecies about those things. Because, as a matter of fact, I think probably none of those things will have any relevance to the United States at all. They're all relevance to the Middle East. The only way it makes sense out of prophecy is put it in the Middle East. If you try to bring it into the Western world, you're in hopeless confusion. That's why there's confusion. Trying to put the common market in there and all that. Just totally absurd. Absolutely absurd. Now when you push it, all you have to do is read Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, all those early prophets, and then read the New Testament in the light of those prophecies, and you get the key. You put it over in the Middle East and it all fits. Try to smuggle the United States into it, or Britain, or Russia even, although there may be some backing by Russia over there, I don't know, but you try to smuggle all these things into it, it's a hopeless confusion. And I've said, and the reason I'm saying this quite a bit these days is because I'm trying to get the Christians off of this anxiety kick. It's damaging to them, it's distressing, and it gets their minds off of Christ and onto all these phony, fears, warnings, and so forth. And, as I've said, if you get a map sometime and take a pencil and start up in the Caucasus Mountains between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, draw an arc, take in the Aral Sea, draw an arc down through, right alongside India, down through the Persian Gulf, pick up Arabia, Ethiopia, Libya, and Egypt, Libya, Morocco, Algeria, come right back up to the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea. And that is the arena in which all the prophecies are going to take place, including the natural phenomena. They are not an earth-wide thing. God is not going to blow up this earth. You got 600 million Muslims, 650 million Muslims. In fact, it is estimated that within 4 or 5 years, 25% of Russia will be Muslim. Right now, if you don't go too far south into Africa, all the coastline of Africa is Muslim, the old Swahili culture, which came up out of the trade routes between the Muslim countries and Africa, Zanzibar, and places like that, the old familiar names from adventure stories, but those names, Zanzibar, and these others were Swahili. But anyway, those places are maybe 50% Muslim. Let's stay up on the north coast of Africa and start at Algeria and go clear across the north coast of Africa. Take in Arabia, all of the Middle Eastern countries, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Go clear up to the Caspian Sea, and all of that region is 85% Muslim. Now that is the arena, and the Muslims are the great enemy of God. The rabid fighters against Israel are the Muslims, and they have a false view of God. They're the ones that Paul speaks of when he says, or Jesus speaks of, and I guess Jesus primarily, that Paul mentioned it too, but Jesus says, he that killeth you will think he does God a service. That's prophetic. Jesus said that in the 24th of Matthew. He wasn't there talking about the Pharisees. They had a slight touch, but the Pharisees were out very soon. The Muslims are the ones that think they do God a service by killing. You get merits in heaven for killing an infidel, which is anybody that isn't a Muslim. And in Revelation, it speaks of those that were beheaded for the cause of Christ. And that was the whole system in the old days of the Saracens, about 800 A.D., really between 700 and 800 A.D. The whole Saracen movement, the Muslims that went sweeping across that Mediterranean area, across North Africa, and clear up into Spain. You see, these people were outgrowths of the movement by Muhammad. In about 650 A.D. was Muhammad's period. And he was run out of place of his birth into Mecca, which has become the focal point of the Muslim faith. Everybody prays toward Mecca. Now, out of Muhammad's teaching came the Muslim. Now, Muhammad was believed that he was a prophet equal to Christ. Christ and he were both, or Jesus and he rather, were both prophets. And Muhammad espoused the same God as the Israel, so they called him Allah. And he wrote the Quran based on Allah, the whole Quran, every surah of the Quran. A surah is like a chapter in the Bible, in our Bible, see. Every surah begins with the phrase Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. It's in Arabic. Bisma means in the name of, Bismillaha in the name of Allah, merciful and gracious. Every day, five times a day, the muezzin gets up on the minaret and calls the faithful to prayer. Now you see, this is the kind of thing that will be, have a form of godliness but deny the power of it. This is the kind of a movement that will be deceptive because of the Allah of the Muhammad, of the Muslim rather, the Allah of the Muslim is the God of Israel in their mind. So they think they're worshiping God too. And the big difference is that they believe, that is between the Muslim and the Christian, the big difference is the Christian believes that Jesus was the Son of God, and the Muslim believes that Jesus was a prophet like Muhammad. Now they wanted their own separate faith. Of course, the Muslims are really ultimately descendants of Ishmael. And all of that mess got started back there in Abraham's time by his impatience, not waiting on God. He went into Hagar. She bred Ishmael. Ishmael has been the heart of the Jewish problem ever since. These Arabs, they're going to drive Israel into the sea. They never change their mind. This peace that Sadat and Carter and Begin worked up is probably the most destructive thing that ever hit the Middle East. People look at that as a great triumph. I'd say as a great disaster, because it's starting the holy war. They're not about, those Palestinian Arabs are not about to let Israel stay there. Now, of course, God is going to have something to say about it. But, see, we're setting things up not for Russia or any of these other people to get involved. Things are getting set up for the Middle East. Now, by the same token, you see, the Christian here in America might just as well get his mind on Christ and go about his work and quit worrying about Chicago blowing up and all these other things happening. And you say, I'm not trying to just give you false hope. I'm trying to give you a reason to focus on Christ and quit worrying about all these other things, because it is just absurd to try and press any of the biblical prophecies into the Western civilization. It just can't be done. I've said before, you just struggle trying to find 10 kings out there in the Western world, and you can pick them up like that in the Middle East. I don't know which 10 kings there are, but getting 10 kings out of the Middle East is no problem. You got all these little kingdoms, and people like Kuwait, and all these are kingdoms. They've got their sheikhs and their kings over them. It's just not natural. Now, God is doing things over there that have to do with that group of people. And if there are prophecies in Revelation that refer to a third of the earth being devastated, you got it over there. That is a barren wilderness over there anyway. Sand and rocks. Not that much to the place. You're just as well off to be focusing your attention on Christ. And that is what Paul did throughout all of the letters to the churches. You never find Paul talking about these things to the Romans, to the people of Corinth. He talks about the new body we'll have, the resurrection. He talks about that all the time. But none of this other stuff. None of the churches get it. Galatia, Thessalonians, he talks a little about the spirit of the Antichrist there, but not in terms of anything other than apostasy is coming. He doesn't use Antichrist. He talks about Satan deceiving the people, that's all. Apostasy, it's what's happening today all over the church, apostasy. People getting off on these tangents. People like the Jones people and the world church. You go into Revelation. Revelation was written to seven churches. Where are those seven churches? In Turkey. Look on your map. Philadelphia, Laodicea, all these are in Turkey. And what does Jesus say to John? These are the things that are. Write the things that are. Now when he gets through writing those things, then he goes into chapter 4 and he says, now the things that will be hereafter. And he's warning these churches in Turkey. It wasn't Turkey then, it was Asia Minor. Now right across the top of Asia Minor is the area called Meshech, Muski, Gog and Magog, which he's talking about, are in that area, north part of Turkey. Now, in Acts, Paul was going to go into Bithynia, and it says the Spirit suffered him not. He never got to Bithynia. Bithynia is right there. That's Bithynia, right across the top of Turkey. What did Paul give himself to to the Gentile world, to the Greeks, to the Romans? Live with Christ. That's what I want to give to you. Do your job. Whatever you got to do. You got a business to run. You got work to do. Do it. Trust in Christ. Leave the care of your spirit to Him. And don't be pushing like a bunch of cattle trying to do something and be something. Let the Spirit work in you to produce what He wants in you. Because all we do is produce a phony, artificial, plastic religious society. That is what the church at large today is becoming, an artificial, phony, plastic society, peddling their wares like soap and toothpaste and Singer sewing machines, and not to mention Coca-Cola, and bringing the name of Christ down into the dirt by all the promotions and Mickey Mouse schemes and gimmicks for being religious. It's just rampant within the church. Gimmicks to get leverage on people to do all these things, get everything going. Whereas the message, the burden of Paul's message to the body of believers is to follow Christ, to feed on the Word, to be at peace. And you will look in vain for any pressure that from Paul on the body of Christians to do all of these things. Paul was given to the Word. He said that he would just die. He was giving himself unto death for the sake of the Word. And there are those that God has called to do that. Those that go in the heat and burden of these things. But it's got to flow. Your Christian life will be satisfying to you. You'll be satisfied with yourself, and believe me, God is satisfied with you, if your life flows in the name of Christ. Don't push yourself to do the things that you don't feel comfortable doing. Not everybody is a mouth, you know. A That seems to be what the only gift that's recognized in the body today is the mouth. And I would that some other gifts might be recognized. Maybe the ear might be a pretty good gift. But Paul says, you know, we're all different. One person's an eye, and one's a toe, and one's a hand, and one's an ear. We need a lot of ears, but we have a lot of mouths. That's the problem. Too many. And everybody's getting confused and disturbed and in anxiety. And it's a, but you know what it does? That the presentation, as it generally is given, makes God a terrorist. Because the motivation and the leverage is all with a gun in your ribs. I'm saying that not just not what the Bible says, what the presentation is. A terrorist, that sounds far-fetched to you. But imagine somebody in another room here with a bomb in a suitcase. And they're saying to you, now look, you people better do what I tell you or I'm going to drop this bomb on you. Isn't that the message in the church today? You better people better watch out and get with it because God's going to bomb you here. He's going to blow this place up. And you better be ready. Now that may sound to some people like a very neat leverage that they can put to get people to do things. But that was not the message Paul had to the people. The love of Christ constrains me, he says. He didn't go around waving terrorist bombs. The net result of this kind of talk has put us in a position where, as it's given, the position is this, that you just better shape up because if you don't, God is up there ready to get you. One turns around and says, now you see, you can really be happy and rejoice in Christ because you turned to Him. But He's got a gun in your ribs. Why shouldn't you turn? It's a very poor picture. I don't say that's what God is. I don't say that's what the Bible teaches. I say that's what the message is. And the result is what? Anxiety. Distress. Who is satisfied with his faith? He keeps thinking of all the things he isn't doing that he should do and all the things he does that he shouldn't do. And it's not very satisfying. You should live at peace. I think it is just a marvelous thing that people walk in this door here tonight and want to study the Bible. That sprig of green. Nobody was forced to come here tonight. There are some meetings people go to because they feel if they don't, they're not living up to their bargain or something. But that's not this meeting. You came because you care about the Word of God. Now, what a beautiful thing that is. What more does God want than that? Now, if I come to you tonight and I say, now you people, now that you're here, I want to just tell you, if you don't get out there and get to work, and if you don't start shaping your lives up, you're going to be in trouble. What kind of a message is that to people who come voluntarily because they care about Christ? And I want to tell you that as you have something in your life worth talking about, you'll get it out. Problem is most Christians don't have anything worth talking about, so they have to be driven out with a cattle prod. Because what are they going to pass? I remember when I was a very young fellow getting my feet wet and all these things, and I was out on a street corner handing out some tracts, and this one fellow said, keep it, buddy, I've got enough trouble already. That stayed with me already for a long time, and I think to myself, he's right, in a way. You know, what did you get crawling into the church, and then what? You just get beat all the time, you know. Beat over the head. Get going for God. Do something. Give more. Do more. Pray more. Read more. Always something more, no matter how much you do. I was just thinking in this matter of the Church of Laodicea, which everybody just loves to quote. They love to take that letter and beat the saints with it. In fact, I've been working with a young lady that almost committed suicide as a result of hearing a message on that. There's that passage which speaks about being lukewarm, and you're neither cold nor hot. Now, if you speak on that subject, I could speak on that subject tonight. The Church of Laodicea, of course, I'd be out of order. I wouldn't speak about it. But I start talking about being lukewarm Christian and so forth. Every one of you in this room would start looking at himself and saying, well, I guess I'm really lukewarm Christian. Once again, we get out of order there. You say, well, isn't that applicable to us today, too, that people can be lukewarm? Well, in the first place, I'm not even sure what lukewarm means. the application was to the Church of Laodicea, who were not people gathering together like you are to study the Word and to be in fellowship with Christ. There were people who were going their way in total indifference, but they're part of that group of churches in Asia that John was talking to, that God said this is the condition of those churches in Asia. The application would be very thin, because it goes on to say why he called them lukewarm, because they thought they were rich and increased with goods and had need of nothing. See, and you people don't think that. You don't think tonight here that you're great Christians and that you don't need anything. The people that I think to myself, if I spoke on that subject, I'm thinking of a person right now up in the chapel there, and if I were to give an altar call type of thing, which I don't usually do, but if I did, this person I'm thinking of, I asked myself, who would be the first one to respond? And I thought of this person, and yet there's probably not a more gracious Christian in the country than that person. But they're also so sensitive that they always don't feel unworthy of Christ. You know, and they would be the first one. And that would be true. The most spiritual people in the group, if you spoke on that subject in a church, the most spiritual people in the group would be the first ones out. Why? Because they care enough that they think they're anything is true of them that isn't, you know, if you say, well, you're not very good Christian, right, I admit that right away. So the deeper one cares about Christ, the more sensitive they are to offending him. And they're the ones that respond first to this kind of leverage. And they're the last ones that need it. All of these things I'm saying to you move in the direction. They're not out of order. I mean, I'm not off the subject, because I'm saying to you that David remains one of the most important symbols in the Bible of the process of the believer's life and what God does with it. And I can use it because he is so commonly referred to in the New Testament. That's why I use that. And this was a whole message in this one in Acts. I saw the Lord, or set the Lord always before me. That's chapter 2, verse 25. Because he is at my right hand, in order that I may not be moved. For this cause, my heart is content, and my tongue rejoices. Because also my flesh will rest in hope, and he will not leave my soul in Hades. Neither will he give thy Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the path of life. You have filled me with contentment with your presence. That's the way that text should be read. You have filled me with contentment with your presence. Now, how many Christians today are filled with contentment because of the presence of Christ? Very few, because they see Christ there as a watchdog in their hearts to see they'd shape up. They don't see him as a comfort. They see him as a caretaker, as a guard, to see that they do what's right. And you get it over and over again. Now, Jesus is watching you, and he's in your heart. If you don't do what's right, he knows. And, you know, just over and over and over again. If there is a problem, if someone is doing something that offends the Lord, he's going to let them know. I'm not saying that we should be indifferent to our conduct at all. I'm not saying that we don't offend the Lord, we do. I'm saying that the essence of our life is not walking a tightrope and living in anxiety over the future. The essence of our lives is taking Christ into the Spirit now and living at peace with him in the world. Knowing that whatever things come up, he's going to take care of us. He's going to help us. We've had lots of problems, lots of struggles. All of you in the room have had your struggles. But here we are, all here tonight. He's gotten you through. We've been around a long time. And we're here. Why? Well, we've made it through everything. At peace. God has helped us. We've had good and bad days. We've had struggles. Not always known how things are going to work out. But they have worked out. And here we are. And what a marvelous thing that is. And our hearts are at peace. And Christ is with us. The glory of God is before us. And so, what more do we want than that? Now, let's go back to Romans 4. And here is one of the most crucial passages in the Bible about the meaning of our faith. What shall we say then that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, has found? For if Abraham were justified by works, he has a boast, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was accounted unto him for righteousness. He didn't even have to go out and witness to get that label there. I speak of that in this vein as a difference. There's a difference between a believer with Christ in his heart giving a witness to somebody that needs help versus being professional personal workers or streetwalkers, you know, getting out there to push the promotions. Abraham believed God and it was accounted unto him for righteousness. Now to the one who works, the reward is not reckoned according to grace but according to debts. But to the one who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is reckoned for righteousness, even as David said, or spoke of the blessedness of the man whom God accounts righteousness apart from works. Blessed is he whose lawlessnesses are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not reckon sin. This is right out of David, you see. The whole burden of this thing is we become God's children by faith, by taking him in, and not by all the things that we do for him, all the things that are put upon us. That leads only to obligation. We were brought here to this earth not by our own choosing. We didn't ask to come here. We didn't had no part in putting this universe together, but here we are, and we want to make the best of it. Under those conditions, it is a marvelous thing one turns to God in trying to make the best of the situation of having been born on this earth. Now, if you put more than that on them in the flesh, then it becomes an obligation thing. There's a good analogy in terms of children, young people in the home. How commonly it is in the home that young people get leverage put on them on the basis of, this is your home too, on the basis of obligations that they never encounter. Now, I am perfectly in favor of, in harmony with the idea that young people ought to be taught to be industrious and to work. I am very, very much in favor of that and did that with my own. But we've got to be careful how much we press young people on the basis that they should be grateful to us for bringing them into this world. The case in point that is apropos here is one that I had of a woman whose daughter ran away several times. And finally, she got desperate enough that they brought her to me. And you have to be pretty desperate to come to me for counseling. This woman started down this line of this girl not being grateful and all. So I said, grateful for what? For bringing her into this rotten world? And this woman, I could see she had a veneer an inch thick. She was a society lady, you know, and so forth. And, you know, pasty-faced, you know, the type, just made up thick. When I said that rattled her teeth. I thought somebody ought to rattle. I suspect she was in one of these Institute of Religious Science or one of these do-gooder operations, you know, and she was just incensed, you know. I said, well, she said, I was taught to think positively. And I said, positively? And at that time, the Vietnam War, I said, millions of people being killed over there in Vietnam. I said, people being mugged and shot and accosted on the streets of Los Angeles and you know, going down this line. And they said, what do you mean positive? And she jumped up and just flounced out of the office there. And the receptionist came and said, what did you say to that woman? I said, well, I just cracked her veneer a little bit. I figured with my own young people, we brought them into the world. You know, I asked the woman in the course, I said, why did you bring this girl into the world? And she started to say, well, because I said, now don't give me that stuff. I said, you brought her in because you and your husband had an act of love, right? You know, you weren't doing her any great favor. You're doing yourselves a favor. Okay, now, in my home, I always believed that I had an ultimate responsibility to those children. I brought them into this world. I had a job to take care of them. Now, of course, obviously, that includes giving them something to go on when they get out in the street, you know, giving them training. My attitude was, I've got to teach my son to be industrious. He's not there to be my slave. And that's the way parents look at their children, you know. Well, you live in this house too. Yeah, but they didn't ask to have a house with an acre of lawn on it. That's your choice. You want an acre of lawn, mow it, you know. But your job with the children is not to make slaves out of them, to take care of something you wanted. Your job is to teach them to be industrious and to be responsible young people. I owed them everything I could give them to give them a start in life. And when I had one to go to the university, I said, all right, we'll just get into a compact here. You do what you can, and I'll do what I can, and we'll get you through. And I felt that the least I could do for him was to get him to a place where he could handle his life properly. And I wasn't going to have him drift around, you see, on the basis that I might say to him, well, you have to earn your own way through. Partly, yes, but it paid off because he was never without a job during the summers when he was off. And the day he left university was the day he had a job, always that way. In fact, his last year in university was earning a considerable income. Now, the result, if there was work to be done in the place, all I had to do was ask him, hey, would you mow the lawn today? Mow it, you know. I didn't have to drive him out there. Now, see, I'm coming from somewhere here to go somewhere else. Where I'm going is what is in Romans 4. Now, this may sound wild to you, but it may be also very comforting. God made this world. He brought us into it, more or less. Parents brought us in. I don't know what the whole issue of the Spirit is, as to where the Spirit originated or what, but at least we're here. Now, for him to come to us, stick a gun in our ribs and say, now look, you've only got one choice. You better follow me and get to work. And this is nothing you're going to rejoice over, right? And I used to say to the Lord, look, I'm not one to argue against you because you made the place. You know, you made me, so how can I fight against you? But don't expect me to be happy with the arrangement. And that was as it was presented. I think I was going to rejoice over the fact that I had a gun stuck in my ribs and say, if you don't believe in me, you're going to be blasted. But people think that sounds a little bit impertinent, but it's true. Well, finally, it took the realization, I mean, to really get me on the track, the realization that's not the way it is at all. We are people he wants to have with us. We're not saved to serve. That's a total misapplication. That puts us right back in the old parental obligation circuit. Yet that song that goes around all over the Christendom, that idea that we're saved to serve. It's the whole thing. God wanted to make slaves. So here we are. Now we have the privilege of serving. That's our gift. That's a gift. I look at the things that I do, like coming here to teach, as a gift to God, from me, from my heart. I could stop this tonight. I could walk out of this door and never go to another Bible class, and the Lord would still love me. I'm still his child. I don't think he's going to knock me down and run over me if I don't keep working. This is my gift. Now, we come to these young people, you see, and we rob them of the ability to give God a gift because we come to them pounding on them to get out and go to work for Christ. You go to these young people's meetings, and that's what it is. And long before the young person has an opportunity to get his head together and say, look, Lord, I'd like to give you a gift, he's already been shot down because he's been made to feel if he doesn't give that to God, he's bad news. He's shirking his duty. Just like if it's parents' birthday and they here's a kid, he's going to buy a gift for his mother. He's got it all planned out. She comes in and says, hey, you know, Johnny, it's my birthday tomorrow. And then he's shot down. It's all over. So you come to a youth meeting, and they're going to get all the young people to work for Jesus. They've shot him down because now, once they give the word to them that if you don't give your life to Christ, you're in all these things they say, from that point on, it's an obligation. They robbed him of the chance to make it a gift. You see, if we give the young people, instead we give them nourishment for their spirits. We show them Christ. And let them, because they love Christ, volunteer their lives for him. Then it's their gift to him. And then they'll do it gladly, devotedly. All of it goes back to the simple point, and I've made it through the life of David, that the chief issue of our lives is to enjoy our identity with Christ. I don't mean fun and games. I just mean to cultivate our life with Christ as something that we find to be the essence of things for us, and something that brings joy to our hearts, brings peace. We make mistakes and we have to correct them, pay a price for them. All of that's part of growing up. It's part of the struggle. And I don't minimize that whatsoever. You have a struggle, and if you don't run your life in some degree of reasonableness, you're going to pay a price for it. So I'm not making life easy. Paul was accused of being a libertine, and I might be accused of the same thing, because I'm trying to bring about the kind of freedom that allows the growth of the spirits and allows a kind of devotion that can never be based on obligation. The kind of devotion Christ deserves is the kind of devotion you could never pressure people into. Because it's a willing devotion. Now, why do I talk about it? Because there is a devotion cultivated out of an open relationship between these young people and their parents that was based on the fact, I owe you something, you don't owe me. Because I brought you into this world, and I jolly well better see to it that I put you together right. And you say, well, how do you get gratitude out of that? By an example. An example of gratitude. I'm glad for having them around. I appreciate them. I'm just so thrilled to have them around. I'm not trying to put on a strongman image. I'm trying to prove a point here to you that you can get far more devotion and commitment out of cultivating a relationship of openness and love and grace than you can out of using all the leverages in the world. That's what I'm trying to get across to you in the matter of Christ. He's not your slave driver. He's not a cowboy driving the cattle down to the market. He's a shepherd who cares for the sheep. And that's what keeps coming through all the time with Christ. He cares for us. He loves us. But he's been made a grotesque image of one whose whole task seems to be to beat the world to death. You hear it over and over again today. It's just as though these Christians just love to tell everybody about how they're gonna be beat to death, you know. Love to talk about judgment, wrath of God. Why? Well, they want leverage, you see? It's leverage they're after. And that betrays the whole of the gospel message. Christ came not to put leverage on us, but to minister to us. He came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. A parent's task is ministering to young people. I don't mean spoiling them. I don't mean giving them breakfast in bed. But ministering to them. Cultivating the relationship of love and strength and grace. Being an example to them of the love of Christ. Not an example of the wrath of God poured out on the Muslims. That's what it's all about today. They're taking this whole Muslim issue, and the wrath of God is going to be poured out on that Middle East in great measure. But when you take that and beat the saints with it, you're just kidding yourself. Christian people are brutal about this thing. They just love today to bring out all these judgments. Well, it's a good escape for them, because it gets rid of all the violent reactions they'd like to have. And if somebody won't listen to their message, they'll fix them. They'll turn Jesus loose on them, and then they'll fix them. Now, I don't say judgment of God is not coming, and I don't say that people are not going to be responsible for their lives. If we make mistakes, we pay the bill. My own young people paid quite a few bills as they were growing up. But that's part of life, part of the struggle. You pay a few bills, and then you learn, and you don't do those things. And we pay some bills, and then we learn that sometimes making it in this world is just a little realism, hard-headed realism about keeping in a budget, you know, or something like that. That might be part of our growing up process. And people that get careless with their actions pay for that. But it doesn't throw them out of the house. Now, as I've said to you here, I think I used to say to these young people of mine that I don't care what you do, you have a place at my table. So they're always were welcome at home. And they paid their bill like anybody else. But the net result is growth and strength and stability of their lives. And that's what Christ wants with us. And it's got to be an example. That's why I'm talking about it, because we need from Christ an example of love and grace, not an example of wrath and judgment. Now you see, the judgment on the Middle East is a deserved judgment. Why? Because the people that today are the Arabs, throughout the history, the centuries of Israel, were battling them almost from hell. The Moabites, the Ammonites, Edomites, all these nations that were the ring around Israel, you see. They all just battered them and brutalized them and fought against them and hated them. And today, they hate them. The Muslim world just hates the Jews. They're going to push them into the sea. What I'm saying is the Arab world has bitterly fought God's people all these years, and that's why, according to the prophets, judgment is coming to them. That's a whole different ball game. You take some poor soul over here in America that's struggling along. They don't hate God. They just don't pay too much attention to Him. They're trying to make a few dollars and keep the wolf away from the door and keep Uncle Sam from destroying them and all that. Just a few little things like that. They're not rabidly fighting God. Not to try to bring down on their heads all this great wrath and judgment of God because they aren't doing everything the way they should. It's a question. That is not an example of the love and grace of God. That isn't to say that people can ignore God and get away with that, but it is only to say to you that there's a measure in which our message to the people of this country and to our neighbors, those people that live next door to them, they're nice people, they play around maybe, or they don't do what they should do, and they trying to just do their job and get careless and so forth. You can talk to them about the love of God. You can talk to them about the meaning of Christ. But don't bring all the wrath and judgment of God down in their heads, see? If their life is falling apart on them, the answer is that they need Christ. There are many, many reasons why they should come to Christ. But don't give them revelation. Give them Christ. The message of the church has become so hard and censorious and sterile and promotional and marketeering, it just lost the vitality of the simplicity of living with Christ as one of His sheep and going through life with the joy of His presence and knowing that in the days ahead we're going to go into His kingdom with Him.